Thank you, Patrick. Thank you for your welcome. And I do recommend frozen golf. It's rather good. I still have all my fingers, toes, everything else. And I had a fantastic time. So thank you to Kirk, who was wherever he is, for organizing that today. Anyway, it's great to be here with you. Thank you so much for your welcome. I always enjoy speaking in the United States. I think there's something about this accent that somehow kind of works here. I remember, I think the very first time I spoke was in, down in Orlando in Florida. And someone said to me on the way out, they said, well, Mr. Tomlin, with that accent, I believe anything you'd say. So you don't have to believe anything I say just because I speak with this slightly odd accent. But tonight, when we were talking about what I'd speak about over these over today and tomorrow morning, Patrick suggested I spoke about this this book, which you have copies of on your table. And I thought I'd begin just by telling you a little bit about the story of how it came into being. I've always been somewhat intrigued and fascinated by this theme of the death of Jesus and the particular way in which Jesus died. In fact, when I did my doctoral studies in a number of years ago, I did it on that very theme, or looking at the relationship between the death of Christ and our understanding of God in St. Paul, in Martin Luther, and in Blaise Pascal. And so it always sort of rumbled around in my mind. And a couple of years ago, I just signed a book contract with a publisher in the UK to write another book on the theme of priesthood. And literally 2 days after I signed this thing, I was feeling rather pleased with myself. You know, I got my next project lined up. I get a letter through the post with a rather fancy sort of crest on the top. And it was from the Archbishop of Canterbury, who was Rowan Williams at the time, saying, would I write the Archbishop's Lent book for 2014? And the way this works is that every year in the UK, the Archbishop commissions a book for Lent. And what happens is the Archbishop commissions someone to write it, you write it. You have to do it well in advance, and so on. So I had to write to the first publishers and say, really sorry, but the Archbishop's asked me to do this thing, and you can't really say no to an Archbishop. If you do, you probably end up in the Tower of London or something like that. So do you mind if I postpone this other one? So they were very gracious and said I could. In fact, that one's coming out next week because it took a bit longer to write. And so I got on with writing this this book. And so I thought about, what do you do for a Lent book? And I thought, this is a good time to revisit what I'd done in my doctoral research and try to write it for a slightly more kind of popular audience and try to make to do some reflection on this theme of the cross of Christ. Anyway, I actually wrote the book, and of course, by the time the book came out, Rowan Williams had moved on from being Archbishop, and Justin Welby was the new one. Now, I know Justin a little bit, and was slightly embarrassed that Justin was rather saddled with this book because he hadn't chosen it, but it was his first Lent book, and he was the one who was there. And in fact, he'd actually got him into trouble because when the book came out, the press in the UK kind of picked it up a little bit, and the Ruth Gledhills, who is a journalist in the Times in London, she got the book, and I don't think she read it at all, actually. She just read Justin's bit, because what happens is the Archbishop writes a little preface for the beginning of the book. And in the preface, Justin had said this. He said, 2,000 years later, the cross has lost much of its capacity to shock and to challenge. For those early Christians, it was a badge of shame. Today, it is more commonly seen as a symbol of beauty to hang around your neck. As a friend of mine used to say, you might as well hang a tiny golden gallows or electric chair around your neck. Anyway, Ruth Gledhill picked up this comment, and the headline was, Archbishop attacks fashion industry. And the article was basically, Archbishop having a go at sort of, making a cross into something you wear around your neck and so on. The day after, in one of the other newspapers in The Guardian, a sort of fashion editor came on and wrote an article saying, what a stupid Archbishop this is attacking the fashion industry. What is he talking about? And it was a little illustration of the kind of, the slight inner world of the media, where the media makes a story and then the story becomes about the story rather than anything objective. But anyway, so when we did the book launch in Lambeth Palace, I did have to slightly apologise to Justin for getting him into trouble on it. To get to the theme itself, I've always thought that one of the strangest things in Christianity is this centrality of the cross. You go to just about any Christian church in the world, and the one symbol that you will find pretty well in every single Christian church is a cross. It's not actually an empty tomb. It's not even a manger. Those get come out at Christmas and they get put away again after New Year. The one symbol that gets there the whole year round is the cross. And we don't tend to kind of bring out the cross at Easter and then put it away again afterwards. We keep it there. On just about every steeple and every outside of a church, you've got a cross. On every communion table, there's a cross. In just about every Christian church you go to, you will find this symbol. And Judaism has the Star of David. Islam has the crescent. But Christianity has a cross as the central symbol of it. And it strikes me that's a very strange thing that we do. Why not have an empty tomb? Why not have a dove, the sign of the Spirit? Why not have something else to symbolize Christianity? Why do we have this particular thing, this rather ugly thing, when you think of it, a cross? And I guess what I want to try and explore tonight and tomorrow is why that is the case, why it is that we as Christians, right from the very early days up till now, are captivated by this symbol, why we repeatedly recreate it and put it on our churches and put it on our communion tables and wear it on our lapels and wear it on our necklaces and so on. Why are we fascinated with this thing called the cross? And I guess one of the first reasons why that is the case is because it is perhaps one of the very unique things about Christianity. Now, other religions have the idea of a God come to earth. Now, there are many of the Greek gods who kind of come down in some human form and appear to other people. That's not a unique thing to Christianity, the idea of the incarnation. Our understanding of it may be different, but that basic idea is there. Again, there are other faiths, other religions, particularly nature religions, that have the idea of gods who die and rise again. You know, the rebirth of spring. Nature religions have that idea. Other religions have the idea of one God who reveals himself to some degree or another in a book. Now, Islam has that as the very center of its revelation. But no other faith has God going to the utter extremes of existence to surrender himself to the hands of his creation to die the most ugly and painful death you could possibly imagine. And Islam is an interesting comparison for us because, of course, Islam and Christianity, we share many things. We both believe in one God. We both believe in the importance of obedience to that one God. We both have an idea of prophecy and the idea that God speaks and that God speaks through prophets to the world. But when it comes to the cross, that's the bit that Islam cannot somehow stomach. And as you may well know, if you've read the Quran or done some study in Islam, that within the Quran, or at least in most Islamic scholars' interpretation of it, when it describes Jesus, the prophet, of course, which is what he is in Islam, going to the cross, actually he doesn't die. In fact, what happens in Islamic understanding is that someone else is substituted for Jesus at the last moment. Usually that's thought to be Judas, perhaps, who gets crucified instead of Jesus. And the reason for it is because Islam cannot contemplate the idea that one of God's precious prophets would end up on a cross, let alone God himself end up on a cross. So here is this paradox of the cross, this unique thing that Christianity has that no other faith does. And when you think about it, and when you place it in its context, the cross seems even more strange and alien as a symbol of our faith. Of course, there were many different kinds of crucifixion. It wasn't a uniform thing. In fact, historians and archaeologists have tried to recreate exactly how people were crucified. One of the few actual bits of evidence we have is one of the rebels in the Jewish Wars who was crucified, and they found his skeleton. And it seems from that that he was crucified kind of sideways with his legs, you know, like that, with a nail, one nail pushed through both ankles into the wood at the side, and the arms hung up like that. And you can imagine in that sort of position, hanging there. Quite different, actually, from our image of Jesus hanging on the cross like that. Maybe he wasn't like that. Maybe it was something quite different. But the cross was... And in fact, the way you died on the cross was not actually from the wounds themselves. The way you died on a cross was through asphyxiation. Because what you did is, of course, you were hanging to this crossbar that you had carried with you. And that was the normal thing. So when Jesus is going through the streets of Jerusalem, he's not carrying the kind of full cross bit. He's just carrying the crossbar over his arms. And that was then pinned to a stake that was put in the ground. And what would happen, of course, is that to breathe, because, of course, your body was hanging down, to breathe, you had to lift yourself up on your legs and your arms. And you might be able to do that for a short while, but you won't be able to do that for very long. And so eventually, as the body sagged, the victim was simply unable to breathe. And the breath would literally go out of the body. That's how you died. It was that kind of death. Now, why did the Romans crucify people? Why did they use that form of execution? Well, it was one reason. It was deterrence. It was the only reason they did it. The message was, if you confront the might of the Roman Empire, this is what will happen to you. And so, the cross was a form of death reserved for particular people. Four kinds of people. Rebellious foreigners, in other words, people from other nations outside Rome who were rebellious against the Roman Empire. Violent criminals, not for highborn violent criminals. If you were kind of aristocratic, you wouldn't end up on a cross. You'd die in some other way. Political opponents of the Roman Empire. And slaves, especially runaway slaves. And the whole idea was that any of these people who were convicted, you wanted to make an example of them. And that's why they crucified people. So they always did crucifixion in very public places. It was never done sort of silently hidden away in a corner. It was always done in very public places, which is why, of course, Jesus dies within sight of the walls of Jerusalem, just outside the walls of the Jerusalem by the Ginath Gate, this little part of the wall of Jerusalem in the first century. And so he dies there so that they can watch him. The audience was vital. And the fact that there are people gathered around the cross, well, that was absolutely part of the plan as far as the Romans were concerned. So this was deterrence. It was public humiliation. And that element of public humiliation, it was basically the idea of the cross for the Romans was that if you ended up on a cross, you had failed. No question about it. You may have tried to get away with a crime, but you didn't get away with it. You ended up crucified. You may have been a slave trying to run away, but you were caught and you were crucified. In other words, if you were crucified, you had messed up. You were a failure, and this was your public humiliation. And therefore, there's every reason why the early Christians would have been embarrassed about the cross. And there are one or two signs in early Christianity in the patristic period that some of the early Christians were slightly embarrassed about it because it was one of the charges made against early Christianity that how can you possibly believe in a person who was crucified on a cross? It's the last thing you would do. And in fact, if you're a new religion in the first century or any century, it's not a good move if you want to convince people of the truth of your religion by placing a failure right at the heart of it. That's not what you would do. You wouldn't put a cross at the center of your religion unless there were very good reasons for doing so. Because, of course, today when we think of the cross, we may think of it as a sign of God's love or a sign of triumph or something we value. But, of course, then it wasn't something you valued at all. It was something ugly. It was something cruel, it was horrible, it was detestable. And yet here is this great irony of the Christian church, that it takes this symbol of death, this symbol of embarrassment, this symbol of failure, this symbol of pain, of agony, and the Christians turn it around into this symbol of victory and of life. Now, here we have this thing, the cross. And what I want to do today and tomorrow is to do two things. And it's two things that this book tries to do. Firstly, what I try to do in this book is to look at the cross and try to understand why the early Christians saw it as so central to their faith. But then the second thing is to look through the cross. And that's what I want to do tomorrow. Because it seems to me the cross is both something we need to look at, to try to understand, to try to make sense of why it is so central to our faith. But it's also something we need to look through. You'll see on the cover of the book, I didn't choose the cover, by the way. The publishers did it. But I think they did a really very good job, because what they did was to take an image of the cross that looks like a stained glass window. And of course, the point of a stained glass window or a window is you look through it. You look at it, but you also look through it. And you can see things through it. And things look different through a stained glass window than they do through an ordinary window. The colors are different. It does look different. The world looks different when you see it through the eyes, through a stained glass window. And it seems to me that exactly the same is true of the cross. That when we look at a whole lot of things in our lives and our world, they look differently when you see them through the lens of the cross. And that's what I want to look at tomorrow, looking through the cross. But today I want to look at this idea of looking at the cross. Now, of course, many people were crucified by the Romans. Jesus was one of thousands. On that day itself, he was one of at least three people. There were perhaps many more who were crucified that day outside Jerusalem. Quite likely there were quite a lot of people who were crucified there. It was one of the rounding up of criminals that's crucified them all together. We know of two others because, of course, we have that conversation that Jesus has with the two thieves or brigands on either side of the cross. But out of all those thousands of people crucified by the Romans, why do we still talk about this one person, this one crucifixion? Well, it is because the early Christians quite quickly saw this event not as a tragedy, not as an accident, nor even as a heroic death. Of course, there is a tradition of the heroic death, the person who gives themselves up for their cause. The classic, of course, in Greek thought was Socrates himself, who dies punished by the state. He goes to his own death. He commits suicide because he's under sentence by the state itself. But there's this sense that with Socrates, when he dies, when he takes his own life, when he is punished, when he enters death voluntarily, it's just a deep injustice. There's a miscarriage of justice that's gone on. But the early Christians never saw it like that. They never saw the death of Jesus as a kind of heroic self-sacrifice, a sort of deep injustice. Instead, they saw it in some way as part of the will of God, part of God's plan for the salvation of the world. In other words, it was what they quite soon called atonement. Atonement, that word, of course, comes from the Old Testament. It talks about the Day of Atonement. The Day of Atonement, when the sins of Israel were dealt with. That they began to see this event as atonement, God dealing once and for all with what was wrong with the world, with the brokenness of the world. Now, of course, there's not much that's explicit in the Gospels in this. The Gospels tend to just describe the death of Jesus. You get a lot more of it in the epistles. And it seems that, again, from very early on, a connection was made in the early Christian church between the death of Jesus and the sin of humankind. Now, when you think of it, that's not an obvious connection to make. I'm not sure that anyone on the first Good Friday, looking at Jesus hanging on a cross, would have necessarily made that connection. One or two of them might have begun to do it. But 1 Corinthians 15, verse 3, 1 Corinthians is one of the earliest writings of the New Testament, written in the early 50s, maybe just 18, 20 years after the death of Jesus himself. St. Paul writes, Christ died for our sins. He makes that connection between the cross and human sin. It's in the very earliest Christian confession. Now, how did he get to that point? How in a very relatively short period, less than 20 years, the Christians had made that connection? Well, two things, it seems to me, historically, tell us why the early Christians made that connection and why they placed the cross so centrally, how they saw it so differently. One was because Jesus spoke of his death as a sacrifice. He makes that explicit when, just before he dies, he meets in this upper room, the room where the disciples, the kind of normal base for their operations in Jerusalem, and he meets with them, and they go through a Passover meal, a regular Passover meal, like people were doing all over Jerusalem that night. But it was a Passover meal with a difference, because Jesus begins to make a connection between the Passover lamb and his own death that's about to come. So Jesus speaks of his death as a sacrifice. Now, of course, there were lots of different sacrifices in the Old Testament. Some sacrifices were thanksgiving sacrifices, but many of them were sacrifices for sin. And so this explicit connection that Jesus made at the Last Supper between his own death and the Passover, that time when God's angel passed over the people in Egypt and others died, the Egyptians died, but the Israelites were saved, and the sign placed above the door that gave a sign that this is an Israelite family was the blood of the lamb painted over that. The connection with that, I suspect that in the early days, the early Christian disciples sort of thought, he did a Passover, didn't he? He did a Passover just before he died. There's a connection there. They made that connection at that point. The second reason why I think the early Christians made this connection and why they viewed the cross as more than just a tragic accident was, of course, because of the resurrection. Because 3 days later, and that's not our theme today and tomorrow, but of course we know that 3 days later Jesus was raised from the dead. And so inevitably the early Christians began to think, well, if God raised Jesus, this man who died on a cross, then there must be more to this death than meets the eye. Acts 2:36. As that phrase, God has made this Jesus, whom you crucified, both God and Christ. And it's a reference to the resurrection. And so in the light of the resurrection, the death of Christ looked different. They had to go back and rethink it again and think, well, there's something else going on in that death. That if God raised Jesus out of all the thousands of people who died on the cross, on crosses in the Roman Empire, if God had raised one man from the cross, then there must be something significant about him. But at the same time, if God raised this man who had died on a cross, as opposed to anyone else, then there must be something significant about this particular death. So here is this idea that the cross in some ways deals with sin. Now that can be quite hard to fathom. Because of course, when you think of your own sins and mine, you may even think of the sins that you and I have committed today. Those little acts of jealousy or dishonesty or selfishness or whatever it may be, they may seem tiny. And you think, well, what have they got to do with the death of Jesus 2,000 years ago on a cross outside Jerusalem? That little word that I said to a colleague at work this afternoon that I really wish I hadn't because I know it was a bit unkind, what has that got to do with the death of Jesus? Well, here's one way of thinking about it. We are perhaps very conscious sometimes that small, tiny acts can have large consequences. You know about the butterfly effect, this theory that the flapping of wings of a butterfly somewhere in the Amazon jungle can actually lead to a tornado somewhere else in the world because it sets off a whole chain of events. A tiny thing can have a huge effect. This is true of golf, by the way, as I found out this afternoon when we were playing golf. When you do a golf swing, this is, apologies to those of you who don't play golf, but when you do a golf swing, you know, the tiniest little change, you know, you move your wrist a little bit that way or a little bit that way, or your hips are in a different way, can lead to a very big change in what happens to the golf ball. You think you're doing exactly the same thing, but it's a tiny little change, an inch out, and shoom, the ball just shears off in one sort of direction. Now, small things can have big effects. Why? Because we live in an interconnected world. We live in a world where what we do matters, where what we do has a chain effect on all kinds of other things. We are not isolated individuals that don't have any effect on anybody else or anything else. We live in a world which is deeply interconnected, where we are interconnected with one another, with nature, with creation, even ultimately with God himself. And therefore, what we do matters. And so therefore, even those small acts of selfishness, those small words of cruelty, the subtle demeaning of others, every tiny little thing like that is an echo of that primal turning away from our Creator that happened in the very beginning of the human race. We are, as human beings, capable of great acts of kindness and love and self-sacrifice, but we are also capable of incredible acts of meanness and malice and envy and greed and lust and anger, and that is true of all of us. It may be that in some people those are exaggerated, but which of us is not capable of those things, those extremes, depending on what circumstances we find ourselves? And so every one of these tiny acts is an echo of something else, something bigger. It's an echo of the deep wound which exists in our world. A deep wound which exists because of the revolt of the creation against the Creator. And that is what we get within the early chapters of Genesis, of course. What we find in the early chapters of Genesis is this account that tells us who God is, who we are, and what the world is like. And it says that you cannot understand this world if you do not see that this is a beautiful, wonderful place that God has created, where beauty and creativity is shot through the whole thing. And yet, at the same time, it is a world which is deeply beautiful, but deeply wounded. And only when you understand that dynamic can you understand this world as it truly is. It's only when you understand human beings who are made in the image of God, created, capable of incredible acts of love and self-sacrifice and grace and so on, but also capable of these horrendous acts of cruelty and violence. It's only when you understand that dynamic can you understand human people properly. Now, here is this paradox of the world. And that is the world as Christian theology presents it. This incredibly beautiful, precious world, but deeply wounded and deeply scarred. And of course, we're always tending to go to one extreme or the other of those. And different philosophies tend to go to one or the other of those. You get the real skeptics in this world who only can see the damage, the harm, the woundedness. And you get, of course, the great optimists, the rationalists of this world, who only see the order and the structure and the kind of sense of order within the whole thing. But it's only when you put the two together can you understand this world as it truly is. So here is this deep wound. Now, right the way through the Bible, there is a sense that for that wound to be healed, something has to be done. There's a deep instinct that when something goes wrong, someone has to pay in some way. There's a very interesting bit of the book of Isaiah. In chapter 24 of Isaiah, it has one of the most sort of vivid pictures of the kind of devastation of the world that we find within the Hebrew scriptures. It says, the earth dries up and withers. The world languishes and withers. The heavens languish with the earth. The earth is defiled by its people. They have disobeyed the laws. They have violated the statutes. They've broken the everlasting covenant. Therefore, a curse consumes the earth. Its people must bear their guilt. It goes on, the new wine dries up, the vine withers, the merrymakers groan, the gaiety of the tambourines is stilled, the noise of the revelers has stopped, the joyful-hearted harp is silent, no longer do they drink wine with a song, the beer is bitter to its drinkers, The ruined city lies desolate, the entrance to every house is barred. In the streets they cry out for wine, but all joy turns to gloom because all gaiety is banished from the earth. There's this picture of devastation, this picture of that we, you know, see whenever you see a part of the world that is destroyed. You think of Gaza, you think of Syria, you think of places that have just been devastated. That's what it's like. And then just a couple of, in the next chapter, we see something really different. In Isaiah 25, we read this: on the mountain, the Lord Almighty will prepare a feast of rich food for all peoples, a banquet of aged wine, the best of meats, the finest of wines. On this mountain, he will destroy the shroud that enfolds all people, the sheet that covers all nations. He will swallow up death forever. The sovereign Lord will wipe away the tears from all faces. He will remove his people's disgrace from all the earth. There's a picture of wonder, of restoration. But of course, the question is, how do you go from one to the other? How do you go from the woundedness of the world to the healing of the world? And right in the middle of these two texts, in Isaiah 24, verse 21, we find this very thing. It says, in that day, the Lord will punish the powers in the heaven above and the kings on the earth below. In other words, there's a deep instinct within Scripture that in order to move from woundedness to healing, there has to be suffering. There has to be some kind of bearing of the cost, the punishment of this. And of course, Israel understood this as being, in order to go from the woundedness of creation to the future, a new heaven and a new earth, that somehow Israel had to go into exile. And the exile of Israel was somehow part of the suffering that they were called upon to bear in order for the world to be healed. Now this idea that in order for the world to be healed, in order for healing to come true, there has to be suffering, there has to be pain. It can't just be glossed over easily. It's something actually not just the Bible understands, but perhaps sometimes our artists and novelists understand it too. I don't know if you have read the book or seen the film, Atonement. The book was written by Ian McEwan. The film came out a number of years ago, had Keira Knightley and one or two people in it. Have you ever seen that film? Yeah, some of you saw it. If you haven't, do go and see it, because it's a kind of secular presentation of atonement. That's our word. That's what it's about. It's about atonement. And the story is of a young girl called Bryony Tallis, who early on, she's about 12 or 13, she mistakenly accuses her sister's boyfriend of rape. And as a result of her accusation, he is unjustly sent to jail, and basically it ruins his life. And it's the story of her guilt. That's what the story is about. And it's the story of how this young girl lives with this sense of guilt from that moment onwards, that she has done something which has ruined the life of another person. And it's basically the story of how she tries to find atonement, because she senses that she can't just gloss over it. She can't just ignore it. Something has to be done. And there's a bit at the end of the book where it says this. What she does is, this is set during the Second World War, and she becomes a nurse. And she works hard, she works her fingers to the bone. And it says this: all she wanted to do was to work and then bathe and then sleep until it was time to work again. But it was all useless, she knew. Whatever skivvying or humble nursing she did, and however well or hard she did it, she would never undo the damage. She was unforgivable. And it's a kind of a tragic story of someone who feels the need for atonement. That whatever she does, however hard she works, she is unforgivable. Because she senses something has to happen. Something has to atone for her sin. So here is Ian McEwan. He's not a Christian. But he understands it very well. He understands that when something goes wrong, it cannot just be glossed over. Something has to happen. Suffering has to be entered into. That sin has to be atoned for in one way or another. And I suspect, and when you, it's very hard to know, isn't it, the psychology of Jesus, to kind of see into his own mind as to what went on. But maybe as he grew through his childhood into his adolescent years into it, that he was aware of that dynamic in the Old Testament, that to move from devastation to healing required suffering, required the bearing of punishment, that someone had to atone for the sins of humanity, the rebellion of the creature against the Creator. And that maybe he began to see it was his calling to bear that punishment, to bear the punishment that Israel was called to bear in the exile, but even beyond that, to bear the punishment that humanity had to bear for their own sin. And of course, when Jesus dies on the cross, one of the things that we can see, especially when we see it in the light of the development of the theology of the incarnation, which develops a little bit later on, we can see a bit of a wider dimension. Because, of course, Jesus dies not just on behalf of Israel, he dies on behalf of the whole human race. And he dies as one of us. He dies not just as the divine Son of God, but he dies as a human being. He dies as one of us. We as a human race bear the guilt that we have borne right from the very beginning, this rebellion of the creature against the Creator, that is echoed every time you and I do an act of selfishness and unkindness and malice and so on. We live under that guilt. We bear it corporately and individually. And yet, and of course, then we think, well, how can that be? How can we atone for what we have done? Just as how can Bryony Tallis atone for what she has done? And of course, the answer is that we have atoned for our sin. We have atoned for in the person of Jesus Christ, because he dies as one of us, as a human being. He goes to the cross. He bears the sin of humanity in his own person. And so that we can, as human beings, stand today and say, our sin is atoned for because our representative, our human being, the perfect man, Jesus Christ, died on a cross for us. Now, of course, that's described in many different ways within the Bible. The image of sacrifice is used, echoes the Old Testament sacrificial system. And we find it in the book of Hebrews. It talks about the idea of Christ as a sacrifice. We find it in the language of participation in Romans chapter 6. There's that idea that we participate in Christ's death so that we can participate in his resurrection. That just as Jesus died to sin and is risen to righteousness, we too die with him and rise to righteousness. So that our sins, if you like, are cleansed as we die with Christ and rise with him. Again, it's sometimes used the image of ransom, Mark 10:45. As that idea of Jesus dies as a ransom for many. It's this image that we are kind of hostages to sin, and a ransom is paid to free us. That was a kind of common idea in the early church, and Irenaeus of Lyon developed it. St. Basil of Caesarea had a little bit of it as well. The early fathers had this idea that humanity owed a debt to the devil, having paid this price, and we are hostages, and that the ransom is paid in Jesus Christ. Now, that can get you into trouble, that kind of imagery, because, you know, the idea of God paying a ransom to the devil, that doesn't sound terribly good, but you kind of see what they're trying to do. But all these images are in a way saying to us that what happens on the cross is that wound of creation is healed. And that's what they are, they're images. And sometimes I think it's better to talk about metaphors of the atonement rather than theories of the atonement. Because what they're all trying to convey is something that is, in a sense, beyond words. Something that you can never get to the bottom of. The idea that in the death of the most perfect human being that ever lived, the one person who combined perfect divinity and perfect humanity, that in that death, the wound of creation was healed. Now, that is something that's almost beyond our comprehension. And that is why the early Christians used all these images to try to explain what it was about. Images of law courts, images of ransom, images of participation, images of sacrifice. Now, there is one final question I want to touch on before we come to a close tonight. When we think about this idea of Jesus, in a sense, having to die for the sins of the world. For the wound of creation to be healed, Jesus has to die. You kind of think, well, why does that have to happen? When someone sins against me, when someone offends me, when someone does something wrong to me, I don't demand atonement. I don't say that they have to go and sacrifice a lamb across the way to kind of atone for their sins. Nor do I say they have to kind of somehow, pay me back for it. You know, if someone sins against me, I say, oh, that's all right, that's okay, fine, you know, it doesn't matter, it's fine, let's get on with life. So why does God demand atonement? Why is it necessary for Jesus to go to the cross? It can seem that God is a little bit meaner than we are. You know, we're pretty cool about this. Someone sins against us, that's fine, doesn't worry, it's okay, you know, we're not going to hold it against you. But God doesn't seem to do that. He doesn't seem to just brush it away like we do. He seems to go through this bloody, awful business of demanding atonement, demanding that his son dies on a cross. Why? Well, this is something that a number of theologians have dealt with over the years, particularly a theologian called Anselm. That's an Anselm back in the 11th century. And this is really echoes of some of his argumentation on this. There are three, I think, very good reasons why it is that God cannot simply just gloss over sin, even though we can. And the first reason is because God is God. When someone offends me, I have no right to demand recompense and to ask for atonement. Why? Because I too am a sinner. You offend me, I've got to forgive you, because actually we're on the same level. I have no right to stand in judgment over you, just as you have no right to stand over judgment on me, because we're both sinners. We're both on the same level. We have to kind of forgive each other like that. Now, I'm in debt myself, so I can't demand justice from someone else. I have no right to judge because I am under judgment myself. But of course, with God, it is different. God has no sin. We see this in that little episode in the Gospels where Jesus meets the woman who is caught in adultery. And here is the crowd gathering around her, and they're ready to, like, a little stoning going on today. You know, here's this woman who's caught in adultery. They're all picking up their stones, and they're all ready to kind of cut, you know. And Jesus says, hold on a minute, stop. And he says, let him who has no sin cast the first stone. In other words, what he's saying is that the only one who has a right to judge is the one with no sin. He who has no sin has a right to cast the stone. If you have sin, you have no right to cast stones because you're on the same level. That's the point that Jesus makes. So, yes, we forgive one another. Of course we don't. Of course we do. We don't demand recompense because we are also sinners. God is not a sinner. It's a different situation. It's a different relationship altogether. So there's the first reason why it is the case that we can't equate our sin against one another with our sin against God. The second thing is because there's a difference between forgiveness and forgetting. Forgiveness is different from forgetting. Sometimes, when someone sins against you, say, that's all right, forget it. And we say that, don't we? Just forget it, it's all right, let's get over it. And we kind of sense that that's what you have to do, you just have to forget. The question is, of course, what if you can't forget? What if someone does something to you that you just, it is so hurtful, so damaging, that you just cannot forget it? And perhaps most of us have something like that in our past. Someone said something to you at one point that you just cannot forget it. And then you think, well, if I can't forget it, how can I forgive it? But the two things are different. What we say when we forgive, or what God says when he forgives, is not that he forgets what has happened. It's not that he glosses over it. What he says is this. He says, although you are the person who did this, although you are a sinner, and he doesn't hide it, he doesn't forget who we are, but what he says is, I will not let this come between us. That is what forgiveness is. That is why it's possible to forgive even when you can't forget. Even when it still hurts. Forgiveness is not the same as forgetting. So, and it's true, isn't it? When we do a trivial sin to one another, you know, you bump into someone, you trip them over, or you just kick their shins in the street or something, that's pretty easy. But something more serious, something more radical is needed. Forgiveness is not forgetting. You can forgive even when you can't forget, because what forgiveness says is, even though I remember that, and I will probably always remember it, actually it's not going to come between us. I'm not going to let it spoil our relationship. That's what forgiveness says. And that's what God says to us. Is that I know who you are. I know what you do. I know the things that no one else knows about you. But I'm not going to let that come between us. And that brings us to the last reason why atonement is necessary. And that is because real forgiveness always costs. C.S. Lewis makes the point that there's a big difference between forgiving something and excusing it. And what we do when we sin against one another is we actually excuse one another. We say, that's all right, it doesn't matter. It's not your fault. There's nothing to forgive. That's excusing. Forgiveness is very different. Forgiveness says, actually, yes, there is something to forgive. It does matter. What you did matter. It was your fault. But I will not hold it against you, and everything between us can carry on. We can still have a relationship despite what's happened. Now, of course, that's not easy. It's powerful, it's necessary, but it's not easy. Forgiveness costs. To excuse is cheap, that's easy to do, but to forgive is difficult. When there's something simple, you know, the kids borrow your car without asking, you tread on someone's toe, you know, that's easy, you just excuse that. But to forgive the drug dealer who sold the drugs that led your child into addiction, that's difficult. For a son to forgive his father's killer, that is hard. Now, of course, when something like that happens, there are two ways of dealing with it. There are two ways of dealing with that level of hurt. Both cause pain, neither are cheap. The first is revenge, the second is forgiveness. In revenge, I make the other person pay for what they've done for me. I make them pay the cost. In forgiveness, I bear the cost myself. That's the difference. There are only two ways of dealing. When something deeply wounding has happened, when a wound that deep goes to us, we respond either with revenge or for forgiveness. It's the only way in which that thing can be dealt with. So both of these things are costly. Someone has to pay either way. In revenge, I make the other person pay. In forgiveness, I pay the cost myself. Forgiveness is only immoral if it's cheap. And we don't want a forgiveness that costs nothing, because what costs nothing is worth nothing. And real forgiveness costs. If you've ever had to forgive someone something deeply hurtful that they did for you, you will know something of the cost of that. Sometimes it is even more obvious. 1978, you may remember, some of you, that famous handshake between Anwar Sadat, the Prime Minister of Egypt, and Menachem Begin, the Israeli Prime Minister at the time. They made that handshake. It was the first time an Arab leader had shaken the hands of an Israeli president. And there was an element of forgiveness there. What Sadat was seeking to do on behalf of the Arabs was to offer forgiveness to Israel and the Jews for what had been done to the Palestinians in that land, and Begin was offering forgiveness to the Arabs for what Arabs had done to Jews over the period since 1948. And of course, that forgiveness cost Anwar Sadat his life. 3 years later, he was killed for that very act. forgiveness always seems scandalous and unfair and immoral. It seems to minimize the crime. It seems to say that it doesn't matter, it can seem cheap. Well, how does this work? Forgiveness always costs. Peter Kreeft, who's an American moralist, puts it like this way. Mercy goes beyond justice. It does not undercut it. If I forgive you the $100 debt you owe me, that means I must use $100 of my own money to pay my creditors. I cannot really make you $100 richer without making myself $100 poorer. If the debt is objectively real, it must be paid. And if it's my mercy that repays your debt, I must pay it. And that is the reason why Christ had to die, why God could not simply say, forget it. Instead, he said, forgive it. And that meant that if we did not pay it, he had to himself. So there we get a little bit of a glimpse into why it is the case that Jesus had to die. Why God had to die. Why God tastes death for us in order that the wound of creation might be healed. And in order that the wound that touches your life and mine, the thing that makes us do those actions of unkindness and hurt and malice to others, that that might be healed. And that is the good news at the heart of Christianity, that he doesn't make us pay, he pays the price himself. But I think at the end of the day is why the early Christians made the cross their central symbol. Because it was in that cross, in God entering into the very depths of human despair and pain, that that very despair and pain is healed.